And tonight we're going to be talking about a scientific method for ghost hunting. It's called paranormal technology. It's really the first of its kind by David Rowntree. So I'm looking forward to this. And we'll be back with David in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Well, welcome back. I'm looking forward to this. Let me tell you about David Rowntree. He has researched paranormal phenomena from a scientific point of view since 1976. Director of the Scientific Paranormal Investigative Research Information and Technology Group, co-director of New Jersey's Paranormal Research Group, a professional member of the Rhine Research Center, and a life member of the New Jersey Ghost Hunters Society. This is the very first time I've seen that there is a scientific method out there for ghost hunting. We're going to talk about that tonight on Coast to Coast AM. Here is David Rowntree. David, how are you?
I'm fine, George. How are you tonight?
I'm fine, too. And I wanted to let you know that I'm co-writing a book with Rosemary Ellen Guiley called Talking to the Dead, and she referenced you a lot. She was just so excited about your work. She's included it in our book, and I just wanted you to know that.
That's great news.
Yeah, she's very excited about what you've done. And, you know, I've been researching you once I knew you were going to be a guest on the program, even more heavily than when she was telling me about you. And you do phenomenal work. How'd you get involved in this?
Well, that's a very good story. I was always fascinated with weird stories when I was a child. And when I was 8 years old, my family uprooted and moved from our ancestral home of Virginia to Florida. And my next-door neighbor happened to be this great old guy that was a retired professor, and he was a pattern maker, but he had this personal library that was just phenomenal with all sorts and varieties of books on the paranormal from, I mean, raining frogs to UFOs. I mean, literally, he covered the whole range. And as a kid, I started reading that stuff, and I started reading Fate magazine and all these things. And I just got hooked, you know, I got sucked right into it and became fascinated with it. And as I got older, I actually started planning my education and career to seriously look at it to see if there was really anything to it or if people were just, you know, really maniacs.
That parallels a lot of what I've done in my career as well. I stumbled across books, Edgar Cayce's works. My mother was always interested in this field. She brought me home a book by Walter Sullivan, who at the time was the New York Times science writer, We Are Not Alone.
Absolutely.
And I was just hooked with that. And then Look magazine does the article on Betty and Barney Hill in their abduction case. And I just couldn't get enough of this stuff.
Oh yeah. I mean that the Hill case really rocked the world when it came out. I mean that it was on every front page more than any other event, I think, related to the paranormal that I've seen in my life.
David, I wanted to get into this business of investigating these stories so badly at that young age that when I finally got a chance to be a radio reporter at the age of 21 years old, I started at 19, but I was working at a TV station as a production coordinator. But at 21, my first radio job, one of my first interview was with Stanton Friedman. Of course, father of UFOs, but
absolutely.
But one of my first interviews was with Dr. Benjamin Simon, the psychiatrist who handled the Betty and Barney Hill case.
That's
and I have still ripped my houses apart wherever I've lived looking for those tapes. I should have saved them because I mean, it was just great stuff. He had told me, for example, that. And I asked him specifically, I said, were they lying or not? Because he hypnotized them and he got their incredible story. And he said, they believe what happened to them. So they're telling the truth. Whether it happened to them or not, he said, I don't know, George, but they believe it happened to them. And that's what he was there for. And it's a great story. So how did you then, as you began to grow into this field, from a youngster obsessed with these books and things like that, how did you begin to push yourself in that direction?
Well, it started, I went into the Air Force right out of high school and finished my education courtesy of the U.S. government. And while I was in there, I got fascinated in electronics. I actually made that into a career and then became an audio engineer and really started to think about a plan to systematically look at some of the paranormal claims. and to figure out a way to measure it or at least document any changes in the environment or anything measurable about these things that could be recorded. When I started out in 1976, I carried around a 70-pound TIAC reel-to-reel recorder.
Yeah.
You know, we pulled up in a U-Haul trailer and told people we were recording bird calls or something like that, because you just didn't tell people, oh, well, we're investigating paranormal activity, because they would, you know, call the people in the white coats back then.
I used to edit audio tapes during my reports with a razor blade, a white grease pencil.
That's right.
A lot of people nowadays, especially the younger ones listening to this program, where everything's so digital and they can do their editing on their computer, they're probably saying, what did you use a razor blade for? Uh-huh. I mean, we literally had to, folks, splice this little quarter-inch audio tape, splice it.
Absolutely. All the editing was by hand.
Oh, my God. We would cue it up by hand, put the little white grease pencil right on that point, so you knew that's where the audio started.
Oh,
and
yeah.
I mean, nowadays, like my engineer Dan, when he edits, he sees the bar graphs on his computer. He knows where the sound is up or down. He sees the dead air in between.
Oh, yeah.
We had to do that all by hand. And then you put a little bit of tape over it, and off it goes. And it worked.
That's exactly right. And the thing is you might spend 5 hours editing a piece of tape that maybe went 2.5-3 minutes.
Yeah, with all kinds of tape splices all over the place.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Well, I mean, I remember when they came out with the little tape splicing machines that were about the size of a pack of cigarettes.
Yeah.
So that you could do it a little quicker, which made life a little bit easier. But, oh, definitely. And the technology was so primitive back then. I mean, we didn't have handheld equipment. There was no EMF detector. There was no... You know, we had film cameras. We didn't have video cameras. We had, you know, 8-millimeter, you know, film cameras, which cost an exorbitant amount of money to get the film developed. And you know, it was just a different time and a different place back then.
At what point did you start tying technology together with your interest in the paranormal?
Well, actually, as soon as I became adult and got out of the military, I started looking for affordable ways to put technology into the mix. And herein, there's the problem. There's not a lot of affordable ways in 1976 to put high tech into a paranormal investigation. Of
right.
course, high tech back then wasn't really high tech either. But there were some things that we did that were affordable. I worked in an industry where I had access to a lot of sound gear and a lot of recording equipment. So we started from that aspect, and we started studying electronic voice phenomena. Of course, back then it was called wrought-iron voices, and they weren't called EVP back in those days. We didn't know what EVP was, but and started trying to figure out just exactly what was going on with these voices that we were capturing on recorders. And we couldn't afford an RF spectrum analyzer then to see if we were getting radio interference. You know, so we were, you know, stabbing in the dark in the beginning. But as time went on, technology started becoming more affordable to the consumer. And really, after the middle 90s, I mean, technology grew leaps and bounds. And I really started to get insights into what was going on with some of this stuff. And it was so rewarding when I reached that point, because some of the things I had suspected all along about these different types of phenomena were starting to appear to be true, which was hugely rewarding to me.
Absolutely. I got to tell you a funny story. When my producer and I, we go through the guests that are coming up for the month, for the week, and she interviews and she screens, and as you know, David, I don't do any of that. The first time I talk to you is the first time you're on the air, because
right.
you know, I don't want to lose that feeling of, you know, spontaneity from you. But she very quickly told me, so we're going to be talking about paranormal technology. And I said, yeah, great, great topic. And David Roundtree is going to be your guest and all that. Well, the name went by so fast. I picked up Roundtree, thought she said Roundtree. And I said to myself, why does she have the actor from Shaft on the program?
You don't know how many times I've had to deal with that in my life. That, and there's actually a David Roundtree that's a famous producer and star in Hollywood as well. And
yeah.
I think we're actually cousins, because we both come from around the same area.
But you don't have the D in your name, your last name.
The name originally was Rowan Tree, Rowantree. And once it came to the New World in the late 1600s, it became Roundtree, kind of morphed into that. I get confused with a lot of people that have a similar last name. But this is the nature of our business.
Absolutely. When you started this then, when you got out of the military, started getting your equipment, how did you even know what you were going to be looking for or listening for?
Well, I didn't. I had to take what we call an educated guess. And I thought, there's some things I want to do, because a lot of people thought that these voices were sound, and yet people weren't hearing them. And I said, there's more to this than meets the eye. It's got to be something besides sound. And I started designing some simple experiments to prove that. And one of the things we did back then was we used Faraday cages. We used bell jars to put microphones in situations where sound would not be coming in. And we would catch EVPs still. We would still capture these voices. And amazingly, inside of the Faraday cage, we would sometimes catch these voices, and that kind of eliminates RF as being the cause of it.
Right.
So, I mean, we were having some tantalizing glimpses, and we started kind of, once we would discover something, then we would, concentrate on that part of it and try to flesh it out a little more until we would build an actual schema of attacking this stuff with some type of rhyme or reason to it that would make sense, and come up with some answers.
I was going to say, was there a trial and error period here over the years?
Sure, absolutely. I mean, with people that worked with me and myself, we tried a lot of things that didn't work, obviously, and it was back to the drawing board. But over time, you learn from your mistakes, and you pick up on the things that you do get right, and then you start to build upon them. And kind of like a brick at a time, the picture started to come together. And it's really fascinating, because probably in the last 5 years is when I've made more advances in what I know about it than the whole entire time prior.
That is amazing. We're going to get a lot tonight into the technology behind this and how it's changed over the years too, and see what it's done for you in your job trying to do this. Are you convinced now that whatever is on the other side is indeed there?
I will say this. I have personal thoughts about it and personal theories about it.
Okay.
But I will say that there is definitely something going on that we don't understand fully that leaves a measurable impact on the environment. And I believe that all paranormal fields have an interrelationship. There are commonalities that occur across the board, from cryptozoology to these ghosts type apparitions to UFOs. There is a common denominator running through all of it, and we can talk about that later too.
When this was happening, did you say to yourself at all, I'm picking up voices from a radio station, or maybe I'm picking up some telephone conversation that somehow is leaking through?
Absolutely.
You did. Because I've heard stories of people through their teeth, they've heard radio shows.
Well, it's funny. That brings up a funny story.
Not mine, but the other people's.
I went to a house one time where an elderly woman complained about hearing a male's voice coming from her bathroom in the afternoon when she would step into her bathtub to take a bath. Turns out she lived a block and a half away from an AM radio station that had a very famous talk show celebrity that spoke, had an afternoon show. And when she put her foot in the tub, the level of the water would create a tank circuit that would bring the audio in front of
That's
the radio
funny.
Station. And it scared her so bad, she would pull her foot back out and run out of the bathroom, and then it would stop.
while she was putting her foot in the tub, he was probably putting his foot in his mouth.
Yes, exactly. Oh, gosh. But, it's amazing, because there are so many natural things that are causing the bulk of this stuff that people are interpreting as paranormal. And the challenge is identifying and eliminating that from the mix, so that what you have left, will stand up to muster, and that's the big challenge in the whole thing, which is pretty much what led me to writing the book in the first place, was the fact that there are so many misconceptions out there, and I wanted to give people kind of a hand guide to go by to understand the technology and what it does and what it means.
Well, what you've pointed out here with paranormal technology is that there's a science behind this. It's not that just ghosts are paranormal or supernatural, but there's indeed a science behind that. And if there is, and I believe there is because you've shown it, if there is that science behind it, that tells you that whatever is on the other side is a very natural, normal part of this universe.
That's exactly right. I mean, we like to, my colleague and I, Dr. Stephen Rourke, we like to call it paranormal instead of paranormal.
Yeah.
And like, it's normal. We just haven't discovered how yet that it's normal. But I think we're going to find out in the end that physics and metaphysics are united. And in order to come up with a grand theory of everything, they're going to have to explore every aspect of this reality. And that includes the metaphysical along with the physical.
Did you have a checklist of things when you started where you went, all right, I got to register the weather conditions. Is it hot? Is it cold? Is it cloudy? Is it rainy? Did you have a checklist like that?
Well, we did. We started out with things that were, you know, pretty obvious. We started out with weather conditions. And amazingly, back then, we started out with any kind of atmospheric information that we could get from NOAA at the time. And, of course, we didn't call it NOAA back then. We called it the local weather station. But where I lived, there was a local reporting weather station at the university in Gainesville, Florida. And we would get up-to-the-date information just by going there and hanging out for a little while and looking at the readouts and shooting the breeze with people. And we would record that information and see if any trend would show up just in environmental conditions, your general run-of-the-mill relative humidity, that sort of stuff, temperatures. And we started to find a pattern in which when these things start happening, a very localized area has alterations in the environment, and they are measurable alterations. And most of us don't notice these things because we're not paying attention to it. We're just going about our lives and everything. But what first started making the news was when people encountered coal spots. And there's all kinds of theories as to what caused the coal spots. Oh, the spirits are draining energy from the air to manifest. And you know, I said, no, there's got to be something more to it. You know, we got to look at this, you know, seriously. And what we did was we started physically throwing instrumentation when we would encounter these things to try to map it out, see what kind of area effect it was, and if there was any other relationships with any other things. And that's really how it kind of started rolling together.
Would that register like that, that if a spirit happened to be nearby, that it was colder?
Well, we found some interesting things. I'm not really yet willing to come forward and say we're encountering an actual spirit. I think what we're encountering, a lot of what we're encountering, is a byproduct of the conduit in which these energies use to manifest. I think probably maybe even 80% of what we encounter is the effect of the conduit itself coming into being that allows the stuff to interact with
right.
us.
Okay, and does it have a different temperature?
Temperature differentials are associated with it, as well as drops in barometric pressure, and these are very localized areas of effect.
Is it dramatic?
It's dramatic enough to measure and to take note of.
Yes. All right, let's talk a little bit more about that. David Rowntree, our special guest tonight, we're talking about his work, Paranormal Technology, Understanding the Science of Ghost Hunting. We'll be back. Well, for just 25 cents a day, you can become a Coast Insider, formerly called Streamlink, downloads, podcasting, and some fun as well, in addition to our video chats now and some more things coming down as well. Just go to coasttocoastam.com and read all about it. And welcome back. We're with David Rowntree, author of Paranormal Technology. David, science is trying to figure out what dark matter might be. Is it possible that this ghostly realm, whatever we call it, that that could be part of where they are or what it is?
Well, it certainly might be a byproduct of it. There's also a thing that is coming out of biotechnology now called biodark matter. In which it may explain a manifestation we term a shadow person, for example. For example, what if a person was made of either antiphotonic content, so that they absorbed light instead of, you know, reflected it or generated it.
Good point.
Or it could be dark biomatter in the sense that it responds to lack of light instead of light as we do, made up of regular matter. So, yeah, these are all things that have to be explored in great detail, and they're certainly tantalizing when we start to look at the possibilities of it. But, yeah, that is a connection, I think. I think dark matter, dark biomatter, all of these things. And we follow at the center where I run here. We follow physics daily and astrophysics daily to look at the discoveries that are coming every day to try to determine how it relates to what we're doing, and we're learning a lot.
Can we assume that your work is almost like research, like a survey, as opposed to just a real-life experience?
Absolutely, absolutely. I stress data collection. You've got to get the hard data. A lot of the problems today is a lot of groups are going out with handheld equipment, and the data is transitory, meaning they read something on a dial or on a meter, and it's gone.
Mm-hmm.
There's no permanent record of it, and all you have left is their word or their report, which is a secondhand account of what that data was. In science, that's a weak data. It's not really doesn't really have a lot of weight. We call it anecdotal data. What we need is hardcore mapped out data coming from software, such as data loggers and that sort of thing, that give us a real-time running code of all the different conditions we're monitoring and how the actual event that takes place affects those readings, and to look for a correlation between that. And that's something I preach pretty heavily throughout the book, that there's no one single piece of evidence that really proves anything. In fact, one piece of evidence is pretty meaningless until you put it into the big picture with the rest of the evidence so that it builds a picture. It's like forensics a lot, where you go to a crime scene and you pick up little minute pieces of information and build a whole story from it. This is very much like that, where we go in and we pick up bits and pieces of data and put it into some kind of order to see if anything shakes loose from it, see if there's a relationship. And slowly but surely, as we're getting more higher tech in our approach, we're starting to find those correlations, and it's pretty exciting. I mean, it's an exciting time for me.
That is exciting. And are you convinced, first of all, then, that weather anomalies or inversions of temperature has something to do with it? Will show that there's some kind of spiritual involvement here?
Well, I think it's certainly these environmental changes are byproducts of the effect it's having on our environment. Absolutely.
All right. Now let's talk a little about EMF. How important is that in your study?
I think EMF is really what my study of EMF in these environments is really what opened up this whole vista of what's really going on here. I started studying a relationship between electromagnetic fields and EVP several years ago and designed a couple of pieces of equipment to monitor it, to compare the EMF background waves to what was being recorded as audio on a recorder. And we started to find that they matched. And we did a series of experiments that pretty well demonstrated that electronic voice phenomena was being created by electromagnetic waves in the voice spectrum, not sound, but electromagnetic waves. Further experiments with some new equipment we recently designed has shown that this EMF seems to be emerging into the environment, meaning it's coming like in thin air from no apparent source, which opens up this whole new vista of possibilities. So when these things start occurring, we throw everything we have at that small localized area of effect to try to map out exactly what's going on. And we've discovered some pretty interesting things.
Like?
One of the things we've noticed is that ion counts dramatically increase. Now, a lot of people discount measuring ions because most ion counters are not that accurate. They run about, for a really good one, they're about 5% accurate. But we're not looking at exact counts. We're looking at ratios of increase.
Right.
So if you have a normal background ion count of, say, you know, 150 parts and it suddenly goes up to 7,000 parts. Something very dramatic has just ionized a whole bunch of air.
Something's happened, or the equipment's not working right.
Right. So we correlated that with increases in radiation. We were getting these gamma radiation spikes, again, in a very localized area, you know, like in someone's living room. Now, normally you don't have gamma radiation spikes in your living room, unless you live, you know, on top of a pile of uranium or something. But these were not steady, you know, decay rates. They were bursts, much like an annihilation was occurring. A subatomic annihilation was occurring, giving out these bursts of gamma radiation. Now, we experimented with a lot of different things to block out cosmic ray interference and things of this nature, you know, using some lead shielding and things like that. And it comes out that all of this stuff is going on pretty much in a very small area where people experience something weird happening to them.
Well, these, and I was going to ask you this, David, do these ghosts have to be in the region you're in for you to study it?
They may not even be in our region at all.
That's what I was going to say. Could they be in a multiverse? Could they be who knows where?
Absolutely. In fact, what my theory has been developing now, that we're actually dealing with a type of wormhole that opens up, connects our universe. And this is heavy stuff, and people are probably going to poo-poo me and everything, but I believe an adjacent universe to our own connects with our universe, and the act of that connection dramatically alters the environment around it to the point where we get temperature shifts, barometric pressure drops due to differentials in barometric pressure. And I also believe that we may not be seeing a ghost, but instead may be seeing the reflection of the consciousness, pure energy on a holographic boundary of a wormhole.
Would that be the same as the soul?
You could call it that. I like to call it consciousness because I think we are on the cusp of discovering some pretty key things about our consciousness, that we are based on pure energy.
Let's assume for a moment when one dies, this consciousness goes into a different plane, which is, let's say, another universe. And somehow this tunnel that everybody says they see, this tunnel of light,
absolutely,
maybe they're going through this wormhole.
Absolutely. That's exactly what got me to looking at this in the first place, was studying NDE accounts, you know, from people who had died, literally died, and was dead for 8 or 10 minutes, and experienced these feelings or these visions or whatever you would like to classify them as. And I started thinking, you know, this sounds an awful lot like a potential wormhole situation.
Exactly.
What if that's what it is? What if that's what it is? And then I set out to try to figure out how to prove that. That's another whole ball game, but we have some promising results. I mean, we are finding time anomalies occurring in these areas. We are finding, like I say, radiation, which would be indicative of particle annihilation. And, of course, in physics, to keep a wormhole stable, you need something called exotic matter, which is matter with a negative mass. And when it comes into contact with our matter, there's going to be subatomic annihilations. Which is interesting, because if we had atomic annihilations, we'd have huge craters in people's homes.
Yeah, that's true. But let's say one dies, the wormholes open up automatically upon death, for whatever reason.
Right.
You know, we don't know these things yet.
No, we don't. We have no clue what starts them.
But some of them go through it, some of them don't.
That's correct.
That is fascinating.
We can assume that there may be some that radiate in a region as energy.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we know that energy can be neither created nor destroyed. So all of those synapses firing our brain that are all EM fields inside our body, when we die, they flee the body. They radiate outwards. Now, the big question is do we maintain the totality of ourself and have our awareness when that flees? And the anecdotal evidence certainly seems to suggest that we do. So now the study is we need to link consciousness and discover how to measure consciousness and look for those signs in the environment. And we've kind of crudely started doing that by looking for brainwave-type waveforms in the EMF fields that we encounter when we have these events take place. And we have seen some waveforms that look sinister, particularly like a brainwave, like alpha brainwaves. So I'm not saying that's what they are, because we don't know yet, but it certainly is encouraging when you start to look for something in a certain pattern, and that pattern emerges even more so than you thought it might be.
Exactly. So tell me then what you believe an EVP, electronic voice phenomena, might be.
Well, I'm pretty certain that it is a form of manifestation of this energy that's radiating out of these wormholes. It may be driven by an intelligent force, obviously. We can't prove that yet, but certainly it seems to be the case due to the content of the information. And I also think that this stuff is, like 90% of most of the EVPs out there, they're just noise. We don't have a way to rate them. We will take an EVP, we'll play it to five different people, we won't tell them what we think it says, and if they all tell us they hear the same thing, then we call it an EVP.
Right, and mostly they don't, I guess.
Yeah, mostly they don't. In fact, in the 35 years I've been doing this, I have less than 50 EVPs on file because of that.
You know it's something. You just don't know what it is.
That's right. And I have some interesting noise, but that's all I classify that as. The rest of them are very clear and concise information that anyone that listens to it picks up. So I think that it's a form of communication. I think this type of EMF radiation, which appears on a low-frequency carrier, like 4 to 5 hertz carrier, may also be related to how mediums and psychics get their information.
Maybe. Now, is the transmitter of the EVP trying to communicate with, let's say, you, the ghost hunter at the time, or is that sound that we don't hear ongoing all the time?
No, it's definitely transitory. It's definitely transitory. And it's almost like these holes open and close randomly.
All right.
And it's very transitory. When it's open, all sorts of weirdness occurs, and we have all sorts of violations of the laws of physics in a very small area. And then when the exotic matter is exhausted or finally annihilated to the point that it loses stability, pop, it closes up, only to reappear at some other time for its own rhyme or reason.
Do they seem to say anything they want, or are they answering the ghost hunter, for example?
Well, in our experience, they tend to be making statements concerning their personal situations, and believe me, this is speculation because I'm drawing conclusions based on something I really haven't identified yet, but it seems like it's intelligent. It seems like it has motivation. It seems like it may have unfinished business, or it may be reacting to the person and the environment.
Is it angry sometimes?
Well, I have encountered things that appeared to be angry. Yes. I have encountered things that appeared to be helpful. I have encountered things that appeared to be matter of fact.
I wonder if they echo the personality of the individual when the person was alive.
It certainly seems to be that way from our research. When we have researched who we think historically we've identified the source, if it does belong to a formerly living person, the traits tend to reflect that. It's almost like it's the personality of that person manifest.
So they really haven't changed yet, have they?
No. And it makes me wonder if we do change.
Right. Maybe in reincarnation.
Yeah, maybe that. But certainly what we've encountered appears to be very identifiable. And the people that were associated, if it's relatively modern, with that person will tend to identify the manifestation with that person. So, yeah, there certainly is anecdotal evidence to support that. And there's content involved in these messages that also tend to indicate that as well. So it's very promising that, that may be the case, but it's a little premature to jump to that conclusion quite yet.
Have you ever picked up a sound that you could then conclude, this is different, this could be angelic, this could be almost godlike, this communication? Or are they all, consciousness of entities you think that might have been alive on this planet at one?
I mean, it's so hard to classify something like that, George, because, most of the files we encounter are weird to start with. I mean, they don't look like normal audio files, and they don't certainly don't sound like normal audio files. They have little little things about them, little quirks about them that set them apart from even radio interference. When we purposefully, like, take a diode, for example, in place of a microphone so that we're demodulating RF in the area and recording that, see if we have any correlation. Even then, demodulated audio off of a carrier wave is very structured. And it's very, you know, you look at it and you can tell exactly what it is. Any engineer can look at it, like we were talking earlier about your engineer. We can look at it and say, oh, yeah, that's audio, demodulated audio. This stuff looks different. Characteristics that are different.
Do you see it coming in real time, or do you see it later after it's been recorded?
No, we see it after we're analyzing the waveforms. One of the tricks we use now is we've discovered that EVPs generally are not recorded with a condenser mic because a condenser mic does not respond to EMF. So we will use a stereo digital recorder and record one channel with a condenser mic and one with a dynamic mic. And we can quickly look at the wave file when we're doing analysis.
We can see the spike.
And we can go to that area and analyze it closer, and it saves a lot of time analysis process.
Without listening to 9 hours of audio or something.
Exactly.
Oh, my God.
And we've all done that, right?
Yeah, we sure have. What do you mean by audio voice phenomena as compared to EVP?
Well, no, that's actually sound. And this is a fascinating phenomenon because, as you know, sound requires air movement.
And sound of what? Music? Anything?
Voices. I have physically heard, like, a baby cry. I have heard a little girl's voice. I've heard a lot of things that were humanistic sounding, and yet they were not. In other words, we had site security. We knew where everyone was. They were not related to anyone on the team or anyone who could have been in the environment. And we heard these and picked them up with condenser mics as well.
Were the sounds directed to the group, or were they just out there?
These were more like we heard a little girl cry.
Well, here's an example. Let's say you're in a mall, and there's a little girl with her mother 50 feet away from you. She's crying. Now, she's not with you. It's not directed toward you. Yet you can hear her cry down there. Is it like that?
It's like that.
Okay.
It's very much like that. Now, I did have one case in Morristown, New Jersey, when we were in an old colonial home where we got a name. Just out of the blue, I was walking through a room, had the recording equipment walking, didn't know I recorded it until after the fact. But I was wondering, kind of out loud, you know, who owned the house? And I got this name, Joseph. Just in a kind of an English accent. Well, of course, in colonial times, we had an English accent. So when we looked back and started studying the history of the house, it turns out that the guy's name was Joseph, and he was like the guy that brought the first brickyard to Morristown. So the guy was kind of like a big landowner, and there's a historic district that's named after his family name, and we found out that it was actually his house. It was the first house he built in the region, in that area. So little things like that, when they happen, kind of reinforce these things that we're discovering. And in that case, it was kind of almost like it was responding to my wondering out loud type of thing, and it gave us kind of a clue, and it turns out that it was correct. And I can't explain that. You know, that's one of those things that you can't explain how that can happen unless there's some kind of intelligent interaction that's occurring.
David, when we come back, let's talk about some more of the equipment that you use for these special ghost hunting assignments. We'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM.